I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. What would you be willing to do to put $2.6 billion extra dollars into your local economy each year? Would you be willing to drive four fewer miles a day? That's what Portlanders are doing, and it's paying big dividends for their city. Joe Courtwright, economist with Impresa Consulting, will tell us about the calculations he's made that produce Portland's green dividend. We'll also find out about Philadelphia's comprehensive program to attract top college students, introduce them to the city while in school, and hang on to them once they graduate. Our subjects are Portland's green dividend and strategies to build Philadelphia's talent pool today on Smart City. But first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Joe Courtwright is our favorite economist. He's principal with Impresa Consulting, headquartered in Portland, Oregon, and works regularly with CEOs for cities. Impresa works with clients to help them understand and deal effectively with changes unfolding in the economy. Portland's commitment to sustainability is often dismissed by critics as a sacrifice only those fringe people on the left coast are willing to make to the detriment of their prosperity and their lifestyle. But you have a new paper out that suggests Portlanders are, in fact, enjoying a green dividend. What is Portland's green dividend?
Well, simply put, the fact that people in Portland spend less of their money on driving, private automobiles in particular, means that they save over $1 billion a year in out-of-pocket costs that then get spent on other things that help drive the local economy.
You say spend less on driving. How much less on driving?
Well, if you look at the national data on how much a typical American drives, it's about 24 miles per person per day. That's the average for all metropolitan areas. In Portland, it's about 1/6 less than that, about 20 miles per person per day. And that 4 miles doesn't seem like much, but if you figure the average cost of driving a car at about 40 cents a mile, multiply that by the 2 million people in the Portland metropolitan area, it works out to a savings of over $1 billion a year.
Now, that must mean they also spend less time commuting.
Absolutely. And if you calculate the value of that time, and transportation economists have developed some formulas for doing that, the time savings are even greater. They work out to about $1.5 billion a year. So if you add those two together, it's more than $2.5 billion in savings from a whole combination of things that just enabled people to live their lives without so much reliance on the private automobile.
And that doesn't include, I presume, you haven't valued in that calculation of $2.6 billion savings annually, you haven't calculated the value, I guess, of reduced carbon emissions.
Yeah, there's no question that lower level of driving produces environmental benefits in addition to the economic benefits. The savings are on the order of about 1.4 million tons of carbon each year that aren't emitted as a result of the greener pattern of development and lifestyles here in the Portland area.
Joe, you made the calculation of 40 cents a mile. It seems like that calculation may even be low.
Oh, yeah. The 40 cents a mile is a very conservative estimate of what it costs to own and operate a vehicle. It allows about 15 cents just for gasoline, and that's figured at about $3 a gallon and 20 gallons per mile. Other estimates are that it's 50 or 60 cents for the typical vehicle. So our estimates, we think, are pretty conservative in terms of the direct out-of-pocket costs that people incur.
Why is it that Portlanders drive 4 miles less a day?
You know, it's not any one thing. It's really obviously a whole combination of things, including the land use patterns. Portland has had an urban growth boundary for more than two decades. Housing and employment patterns as a result are much more compact than they are in most other metropolitan areas in the United States, which means people don't have as far to travel for work or for shopping. In addition, there's a very good mass transit system. People in the Portland area are about twice as likely to use the transit system as people in the typical area in the United States. And there are a plethora of other transportation alternatives. Bicycling, for example, is very popular. Bicycle commuting is about 7 times more popular in Portland than in the typical metropolitan area in the U.S.
Wow. And again, for Portlanders, does this seem like a sacrifice?
No, I think in many cases it represents the voluntary market choices of the people who live here. And you see that in things like hybrid ownership. Portland has the highest level of per capita ownership of hybrid automobiles anywhere in the U.S. And also when opinion pollers ask people their opinion of the transportation system, people in the Portland area, by a margin of about 60%, rate the transportation system here good or excellent, compared to only about 35% in the typical metropolitan area in the U.S.
You make the point in your paper that the green dividend for Portland is even bigger than the numbers make it appear, because Portland doesn't make automobiles and doesn't produce gas.
Exactly. The money that gets spent on transportation, probably 90% of it, automatically leaves the local economy. So that when you buy a new car, when you spend money on gasoline, it goes out of state. So when people don't spend money on those things, and we know people in Portland spend about 20% less on those things than the typical American, that gives them more money to spend on other things, most of which are things that they buy locally, whether it's houses or shopping for things or services that they would buy locally. So it actually stimulates the local economy.
Well, it is indeed a dividend. How did Portland get here? You talk about the mix of decisions over the years. I'm back up even from there. How long in the making have the combination of strategies been at work to result then in this green dividend? And I'm interested, Joe, even behind that, the strategies came from an ethos, from a value system, from good decision making. I mean, help me understand the Portland story behind the green dividend.
Well, I think there are a lot of threads to that story, but they clearly go back at least to the 1960s, at a time when there was a real strong emphasis on planning and alternatives to the automobile and transportation, and decisions that were made about planning for an urban growth boundary, planning for higher density, investing in transit, and choosing not to build a lot of new freeways. All of those things helped set this trend in motion. And then they've been amplified by the decisions that people have made to choose to live in those denser neighborhoods, to bike more, to use the transit system and the like. So it's really the cumulative result of literally decades of both public sector investments and then individual private decisions.
So almost 50 years in the making. Can other cities duplicate Portland's set of decisions that have led to this green dividend?
Well, I think certainly there are aspects of what Portland has done that could be replicated elsewhere. I'm not saying that everybody should follow exactly the same formula, but I think what it points up more than anything else are the gains that accrue to cities and to places that pursue greener strategies. Different places may have different recipes for how to do that, and it's certainly not easy. But when you do it and you do it well, it actually has a significant benefit for your local economy.
One of the questions I'm often asked is, what form of governance is the magic form of governance? Which is the one that will always take you to the promised land? And it's interesting, when you look at Portland's success, oftentimes people expect a strong mayor to be an essential component of urban success. And yet it seems to me, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that Portland doesn't have a strong mayor system.
Yeah, the form of government is not a strong mayor. In fact, it's a weak mayor-council arrangement, where the mayor at least nominally has basically the same voting power as every other member of the five-member city council. That said, there have been leaders along the way who I think have given voice to and really pushed along a number of these policies. But it was really because I think they engaged the community and got a lot of support and built what has proved to be an enduring consensus around a lot of these policies.
And have those leaders always come from government? Have they always been the mayor, or have other sectors produced that leadership?
Yeah, I think the leadership is pretty diffuse throughout the community, and there are people who are both in the public sector and private sector who have contributed to that, and people who have contributed in both roles. And I think having a tremendous culture of civic engagement, civic involvement, means that those lines are just necessarily blurred. So it's a difficult question to answer.
Sometimes civic engagement, as you know, can be very destructive. I mean, it can result in lots of hand-wringing and years of simply delayed decisions because no one can make a decision. How has Portland been able to establish a productive culture of civic engagement?
I don't know if I know the answer to that question. I think one of the things we observe is that people here are viewed as being in love with process sometimes. We have too many meetings. But I think ultimately it's the willingness to meet, the willingness to talk, and the continuity of that process that you have to go through in order for it to work. So I'm not sure I know what the magic is. I think you just have to keep working at it.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Joe Courtright. He's just produced Portland's Green Dividend for CEOs for Cities. I was in Portland recently talking to a number of different groups, and it certainly becomes evident quite quickly that Portland has this very strong do-it-yourself culture. And it seems to transcend the tech community. It goes beyond young people. It seems to be throughout. Do you think that is tied in any way to the productive civic engagement that exists in Portland? And again, this willingness to make these decisions that, again, in the end have resulted in quite a savings for Portland and probably a stronger local economy.
Well, I think there's a theme of openness to new people and to new ideas that permeates the economic life of the region, the cultural life of the region, and also I think characterizes the political life of the region as well. And it's a place where people with different ideas, with new ideas, are more than tolerated. I think they're encouraged, and what that means and can mean is that we're better positioned to innovate and tap into some of these possibilities.
On the other hand, the flip side of the do-it-yourself culture, if you listen to Portlanders, is they will say, well, but there's not a strong culture of corporate philanthropy. There's not a strong corporate voice, not even a necessarily strong individual philanthropy. Do you think that is a true? And if so, do you think it's sort of the inevitable pairing with do-it-yourself culture?
Well, I think it'd obviously be nicer if Bill Gates lived in Portland rather than Seattle and would be a philanthropist here. I mean, there'd be more money for a lot of very worthy causes. But I think it also just, requires or produces a set of conditions where people have to work harder and maybe do things at a smaller scale. So it would be nice to have, but I'm not sure that it hasn't not having it has not had some beneficial effects.
If you were advising a community, Joe, that wanted to grab this green dividend starting today, wherever they begin, what would you advise them to do? What are the first two or three possible steps they could take to move toward this green dividend?
Well, I think the first and most important step is to recognize that you can pursue a green agenda without sacrificing your economy. In fact, the opposite is true. If you really do a good job of thinking long term about the way you prepare and you develop your community, It can have some real economic benefits that produce effectively higher income for your residents. So approaching it with that frame of mind may be one of the most important things to do. I think there's a critical step here of recognizing that communities offer people choices and choices of where they want to live and how they will live and get around. And the more choices you can offer, particularly in dense neighborhoods and in really strong inner city neighborhoods, the more options people have to choose to have a lower energy consumption kind of lifestyle. And then that means that they can spend more money on all the other businesses that populate your local economy.
You talk about the local businesses that populate the economy. Portland has a very impressive group of independent businesses. And I'm wondering if you think the driving less, walking and biking and transit more money, again, to spend on the local economy because it's not being spent on transportation costs that then leave the community. Do you think those two things are tied together?
Yeah, we have some, I think, pretty good circumstantial evidence that that's the case. We don't know exactly where the money goes that people don't spend on transportation, but we know that people here spend more on some other things. They spend some more money on housing. You see a lot of rehabilitation of housing, again, particularly in the city, and that's a very strong industry locally. A lot of money gets spent on the city's food culture. Portland has the second highest number of restaurants per capita of any metropolitan area in the United States. So that money goes somewhere, and it's very likely that it shows up in the coffers of a lot of local businesses.
You've reminded me that one of the points you make in the report is that housing cost and transportation cost, household transportation cost, are actually tied together, and they move in opposite directions. If you spend more on transportation as a household, you're tending to spend less on housing and vice versa.
Right.
And that's an interesting, I think that's an interesting equation because we don't typically look at those two costs as one.
Right. And that's most of what people pay for in the price of housing is accessibility to things. It can be accessibility to jobs or to schools or to a whole variety of consumption opportunities. And generally speaking, the more money you pay for your housing, the more access you're getting to a whole range of public and private services that may be nearby, or amenities, things like parks and environmental quality and open space and so on.
And in terms of cost, give me a sense relative to other top 50 metro areas, the cost of living in Portland. I'm just not familiar with it.
Well, people in Portland spend somewhat more of their income on housing than would be true nationally. But then the combination of spending on transportation and housing is very much in line with the national average. But the price of housing here is somewhat more expensive than in the rest of the country, although considerably lower than in other places on the West Coast, say in California or the Seattle area.
There are a number of critics that simply rail against the kinds of strategies that Portland has pursued, a growth boundary, trying to contain sprawl, compact development, mixed uses, as being some sort of a terrible plot to keep Americans from having the choices they need and to keep prices high. I just want to give you sort of one more chance to make the case, because I know you think you believe the facts show that that's not true.
Yeah, it's definitely not true. I mean, people are definitely voting with their feet, and they're moving to the neighborhoods that offer a lot of those choices that you don't find everywhere. The neighborhoods that are pedestrian friendly and relatively dense and have good transit options and so on. So this is not some conspiracy of some backroom planners to foist a lifestyle on people. This is something that a big segment of consumers in this country are actively choosing. And the interesting thing is you know, every metropolitan area in the United States has suburbs and some nice suburbs. What really differentiates metropolitan areas in the U.S. is some have very desirable close-in neighborhoods and others don't. So if you really believe in choice, and I certainly do, you know, giving people choices of dense, transit-served, walkable neighborhoods is really something city planners ought to focus on.
Joe, do you think the Portland Green Dividend is going to become a new rationale for sustainability or green strategies?
Yeah, I hope what it does is gives people who are thinking about this issue the ability to sort of break free of this mantra that somehow that when you do things to protect the environment, you're hurting your economy. Because there's that's a popular folk wisdom. It's certainly the subtext of a lot of critics of smart growth, but empirically, it's just wrong. And particularly in places that do this in a systematic way, it's really clear that it's a benefit to the local economy. And when you see things like rising gas prices, which is clearly on the minds of a lot of consumers these days, places that give you options and where you have to drive less means that you're less affected by those changes. So it's a really positive development from an economic point of view and not a burden on the economy, as so many people have maintained.
Joe, you're our favorite economist. Thanks again for being our guest on Smart City.
Always a pleasure.
Joe Courtwright heads Impresa Consulting in Portland, Oregon. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planetta's and assistant editor, Nate Berg.
2 years after the Supreme Court's eminent domain ruling in the case of Kelo versus New London, Connecticut, two members of the U.S. House of Representatives have introduced a bill to limit the powers the ruling granted. Wisconsin Republican James Sensenbrenner and California Democrat Maxine Waters have joined forces to try to stop the federal government from providing funding to local and state governments that are trying to use eminent domain to promote private development. Dubbed the Private Property Rights Protection Act of 2007, the bill is actually a do-over of a bill introduced in 2005 right after the ruling. That bill, the Private Property Rights Protection Act of 2005, overwhelmingly passed in the House, but was killed on the Senate floor. The updated bill looks to protect both homeowners and tenants, an additional protection the bill's sponsors hope will win over their colleagues in the Senate this time around. Meanwhile, San Francisco is undergoing an unconventional economic boom. The Economist reports that the city is rebounding from the dot-com bust at the turn of the century with a large influx of high-tech jobs and high-end retailers. Increasingly, the city's families and younger populations are being replaced by wealthy baby boomers, many of whom are only in the city as part-time residents. Between 2000 and 2005, the city's population of 20 to 30-year-olds dropped by 38%. And though not as vibrant as during the dot-com era, the city's job market is still thriving. But many worry that the rising value of property in the city will push even more young people out, and keep many others out in the suburbs. And for all those who are still out in the suburbs, a new battle is raging in front yards across America. But it's not over eminent domain or rising house prices. This war is over the lawn, and how the way one homeowner keeps his grass the greenest can have a deleterious effect on the health of neighbors and the environment. An article from the Wall Street Journal looks at how literal grassroots movements across the U.S. are trying to get their neighbors to cut down on the use of pesticides on lawns. Recent studies finding links between common pesticides and Parkinson's disease have upped the urgency of these efforts. But for many lawn gardeners, trading the greenest lawn on the block for the safest one is a hard sell. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor of Planetizen. After a short break, we'll find out about Philadelphia's secrets on attracting and retaining talent. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. John Herman and Josh Seven are partners in attracting and retaining young talent for the city of Philadelphia. John heads Campus Philly, an organization that promotes active involvement by college students with the city's social, civic, and professional communities. Campus Philly is trying to change what it means to be a college student in Philadelphia. Josh is the manager of Knowledge Industry Initiatives for Philadelphia's Department of Commerce. He's responsible for coordinating the city's efforts to attract and retain young knowledge workers and to expand knowledge-based industries. Josh, in 2000, Philadelphia ranked 92nd out of the 100 largest U.S. cities in the percentage of population with a bachelor's degree or higher. But the city is also home to an unparalleled collection of institutions of higher learning. How do you reconcile those two facts?
Well, it's something that we really focus on because that indicator, 92nd out of 100, is central in a lot of our minds as an indicator that really has to be moved, because we know that cities in the innovation economy, their ability to grow and succeed relies so much on those educational attainment levels. So it really does come as a bit of a shock with the number of universities that we have to have such a gap between educational attainment in the city, given the assets that we have. When you look at the region, the numbers aren't nearly as dire. We end up, instead of being there near the bottom of the pack, we tend to be in the second tier of regions in terms of educational attainment. So therein lies a bit of a there's a bit of a tale of two cities here in this region for a significant amount of the workforce that hasn't connected into the innovation economy and gotten that all-important degree and a significant part of our economy, which is in the mainstream and does have that required educational credit.
Although you've had population gains in the center city, Philadelphia continues to lose young people, lost more than 3,000 young adults between 1990 and 2000. John, have you made an assessment as to why that's happening?
In terms of why that's happening, really in the 90s, there was a turnaround time in the city. So, it is a national trend. Northeast cities in general have been losing young adults, and a lot of those cities did make a comeback, so to speak. Certainly New York and Boston were, and D.C. were further ahead than Philadelphia. So Philly was addressing our crime issues in the 90s, our financial stability, and the city seen an explosive growth of the types of amenities and jobs and lifestyles that attract young people since the early 90s that has made at least the center city much more attractive. As Josh had said, the region has generally been strong, not quite as strong as we think that it needs to be, but the growth overall in the city and region has outpaced the country in terms of the change positively towards the number of people with bachelor's degree or higher since between 90 and 2005.
To what do you attribute that?
There's a lot of various reasons. One has been the overall downtown revitalization. I think that the city and the region are more – they're both more attractive to college graduates than they used to be. I think that the business community has been more organized. The I guess we've been doing well with the baby boomers in terms of the empty nesters moving into the city or choosing to stay in the Philadelphia area maybe. Really, Philadelphia has finally come into its own. There's been a feeling that one of our advantages is that there's a low cost of living, and people must have finally caught on to that at some point in the last 5 to 10 years. And really, it's not just a relatively affordable place compared to Boston, New York, and San Francisco, but it's a really exciting place to be, and there's great cultural amenities, and there's a diverse economy, and the biotech life science sector has really grown, and that's one of the anchor industries in the Philadelphia region.
What is it about the downtown revitalization that you believe attracts young adults?
I think that it started in Philadelphia with restaurants, I feel. I mean, I'm sure that if when people tell the story of the city, they talk about Governor Rendell when he was the mayor and the fiscal stability and Paul Levy with the Center City District and cleaning Center City, and there's a lot of those infrastructure items. But in terms of what the public saw, I feel as young people when I was in college in the late 90s that it just seemed like the city was just getting cleaner and more exciting, and restaurants are one of the real strong assets here in the arts and culture institutions, and that has just exploded. There's been much more outdoor seating in the summer than there used to be. There's more shopping. For decades, the city tried to lure high-end shopping establishments into the city, and it finally happened in the last 10 years. And so it's – you don't have to go to the King of Prussia Mall all the way out in the suburbs anymore. So I think from a young person's perspective, you can envision living the lifestyle in Philadelphia that really wasn't available maybe 15, 20 years ago. And the issue is that it's not that there aren't great places to live outside the city in greater Philadelphia, but a region can't survive and grow without the center core and the city being real strong. So I think that overall it's been a lifestyle and obviously there's a lot of companies that have been growing in Center City as well. But it's just a really different city than it used to be.
And momentum is a really big part of it, because as a lot of these changes in the positive direction got Philadelphia into a better place, attitudes started to change.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes a virtuous cycle. And in particular, among the demographic we focus on, college students and young professionals, they're not carrying the same baggage that Philadelphians often carry about their city. And there's often a kind of well-noted defensiveness that Philadelphians often, native Philadelphians, longtime Philadelphians, carry about with them about their city. You have new Philadelphians, young Philadelphians, seeing this city anew. So when they come to Center City or they see the diversity of offerings and the authenticity of Philadelphia, they don't have some preconception to get in the way of all of that, all of those positives that they're taking in. So I think everyone always talks about the tipping point. You get to a certain point where attitudes tip. And I think that's where we are now with the kind of real positive focus that there is on life in the city now.
Do you think, Josh, that locals with what you call their cynical attitudes can affect the attitudes of young adults, or do they just pay no mind and form their own opinions?
Whether the longtime local cynics can affect the attitudes of young Philadelphians?
Yeah.
I think a lot of young Philadelphians, I think they get a kick out of it. There's, again, I mentioned authenticity. There's this kind of grittiness, griminess. It's what a lot of young people who maybe have been to other boom towns that may seem a bit more just whitewashed or bland, or where's the there? Where are the neighborhoods? Where is that, kind of cynical guy sitting on the stoop who's, has been there for generations? It's part of what people embrace about the city. So sometimes it can be hard to get those generations truly mixing, but I think there's enough dynamic kind of urban activities here, whether it's how crazy people get around a sports team that really unifies Philadelphians together, or all the kind of events that we have downtown, or culture. There are a lot of things that do mix these generations together. So all of the attitudes do kind of somehow get in the same room.
And to add to that point, there's about 365,000 college students in the region. About 3 out of 5 of them are from the greater Philadelphia area originally. And one of the challenges and dynamics that exists in Philadelphia is that we actually have a very diverse, what I call, scene, whether it's arts and culture, or restaurants, or jobs, or whatever it is. Philadelphia has one of everything. New York, to a lot of students, seems to have 10 of everything. And when they don't know about the one of everything in Philadelphia or the two of everything, they sort of think it may not be there. And a lot of other cities don't even have that. And so we have really any type of student or person or young adult can have the kind of experience that's important to them in the Philadelphia region. But they historically have actually had to rely on Philadelphians to tell them about it. So when you're in college, it's your friend who grew up in Philly that would tell you where to go in the city. And they may not, if they grew up in the suburbs, know all of those details, especially as, a decade ago, the city wasn't as attractive a place or a place where their parents might have taken them to quite as often. And that's certainly changed a lot. The tourism industry has boomed, and a lot of tourism has included regional tourism people in the suburbs going to the city. So what we do as Campus Philly is really try to fill that information gap. We have a website and publications, and it starts with the college prospect and it goes all the way through senior year. We organize a major festival, and it's all about getting students the tools to discover Philadelphia on their own, so they and to encourage people to tell their friends. We're not trying to take the place of the Philadelphian who tells their friend about where to go, but the dynamic here is that you need a friend to tell you where to go, and now you can use Campus Philly and get some of that without whether you know someone from Philly or not.
John, tell me that number of college students again.
In the region, there's actually 365,000 college students. That includes,
that's an amazing number.
Yeah, it includes both full-time and part-time. And despite the size of the number, we're still about seventh in terms of the region's overall college student population.
Well, it's a huge number nonetheless. I want to come back to the specifics of Campus Philly. You say you do a festival each year, a newsletter. Your job is to provide the tools to discover Philly and get help students discover Philadelphia and then tell friends about it. Beyond the festival, beyond the newsletter, anything else that you do to get the word out and then get the word spread?
Sure. There's basically a three-part strategy that has evolved. And we work with a lot of different regional and local organizations on that work. It had started 4 years ago as the Knowledge Energy Partnership, bringing three or four different nonprofits together. And the first part of the strategy is to attract more and better students to go to schools in the Philadelphia area. And there's a domestic component with a magazine, Campus Visit Philadelphia, and a website, onebigcampus.com, as well as an international strategy. The idea is that on that front, the source of admissions, all the colleges in the country have increased their enrollments in the last decade, and that's going to peak within the next few years. And that's simply a demographic issue. The number of baby boomers' kids that exist is finally that demographic wave is ending soon. And all the expansion that the schools have had will reach a peak. So we've also started investing in an international source of students. So far, it's been mainly focused on a relationship with Korea and Japan, and we've been at college fairs in those countries promoting going to schools in Philadelphia. And we've also had a small trip to Canada recently. So that's the first part, attracting more and better students. The middle phase of engaging students in the experience while they're in school, as you had mentioned, includes our festival and our website and our e-newsletter, and there's 25,000 students that are on our weekly email. It also includes a community engagement strategy. We've just developed a new program to connect students to nonprofits, both for career path type volunteering as well as general volunteering. And then the third piece is perhaps the most critical, is getting students connected to a job or an internship. And our strategy on that front has been focused mainly on what connections can we create between students and employers prior to senior year. So we assume that if there's an open job for a college graduate that it'll get filled. And we also, you know, can't just call a company and say, can you create more entry-level jobs? If anyone could figure that out, as I always say, they'd be famous. But we can call a company and say, how many interns do you have? And can you create either more internships or opportunities where you mentor young people or just tell people about your companies? One of the challenges, because the jobs are spread out across the region, is simply communicating to students what are the opportunities and career paths and industries and companies that are significant in the Philadelphia region. And they may have their mindset on New York as, you know, if I'm going to do financial, I'm going to do New York. And if I'm going to do political work, I'm going to go to D.C. And, you know, maybe some people know that if you're going to do pharmaceuticals or life sciences, you're going to be in the Philadelphia region. But, A, that's not told enough. And, B, there's more of a job for us to paint that picture. So we have primarily focused on internship fairs and our website that connects students to internships and jobs, as well as a networking event that we're launching this fall. And we're going to get into this, what we call career path marketing, of marketing to students the industries and companies and jobs that they can expect to look for in this region.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guests are John Herman and Josh Seven. They're partners in attracting and retaining young talent for the city of Philadelphia. And then, Josh, where do you pick up as manager of the Knowledge Industry Initiative for the city of Philadelphia? How do you then take what Campus Philly is doing and then extend that so that the city, in fact, can retain the young people that you're trying to hold on to?
Well, there are a variety of initiatives that Mayor John Street has led, very exciting initiatives. Campus Philly being in some ways really the main central one, and one where several years ago all we had was an identification of demographic and that number, that impressive number, 365,000 students. and a program was developed out of it that has become a national model. There have been some other approaches around this issue of talent-based economic development focusing on young professionals that the city and the mayor has really helped support. There's an organization called Innovation Philadelphia, which is a nonprofit supported by the city that has staked out a focus on 25 to 34-year-olds. In some ways, Innovation Philadelphia picks up where John and Campus Philly leave off. Once you graduate, Innovation Philadelphia is devising a set of programs to promote the region's assets, connect people to the variety of young people, organizations, professional, personal, or otherwise. Also, similarly, marketing the specific industries and opportunities within them, connecting those young professionals with job opportunities in the area. Because a lot of this group, 25 to 34-year-olds, a lot of them have already really taken to Philadelphia. What we often hear them say is, it really comes down to the job opportunity and if the career path is here. So Innovation Philadelphia developing programs to foster those connections and also just to celebrate and showcase young professionals through what Innovation Philadelphia calls innovation forums, events, and awards. So there's a set of activities there. The city has also supported post-graduation fellowship programs. So the city has just launched its version of New York City's Urban Fellows Program, where we are taking people have just graduated from graduate studies programs and getting them into city government for a year in a highly competitive program. So we also do the same thing. There's a fantastic nonprofit here called Philly Fellows that does the same thing for the nonprofit sector. They focus specifically on area college graduates and getting them to be placed in some of our most capable nonprofits within the city for a year. And there's a set of auxiliary programming for these fellows to expose them to the city, get them connected to increase the chances that they decide, this is where I want to make a career.
Now, this is really hard to do, but have you been able to determine how well the program is working and which parts of the program are contributing the most to moving the needle?
We have a lot of baseline data, really. The good news overall was when the census did their sort of in-between censuses analysis that our overall educational attainment rate seems to be going up faster than the nation. But that encapsulates a number of different factors. In terms of our work, we know that about 3 out of 5 college students do stay in the region when they graduate. But we also know that it's a much higher number of people who grew up here, and it's a much lower number of the people that did not grow up here. And we did a comparison with Boston, working with our colleagues in Boston, and they had done a similar survey and found that Boston actually has a slightly lower overall retention number, but they keep a much higher number, about 50% of their non-native Bostonians in the region when they graduate. And we obviously want to keep as many students wherever they're from in the region and the city after they graduate. But if we're not going to have that inflow of new talent from the, you know, around the country and around the world, then we're not going to be able to grow as a city. So we have to educate our own and attract and retain the outsiders as well.
Carol, to add, in terms of measuring outcomes, because it is a challenging thing to do, something that we're looking at is surveying graduates several years after graduation. The last couple of survey instruments that we've used have followed up with people 6 months after they've graduated. Philadelphia, to really overall see how effective these activities are, needs to look 3, 4, 5 years out. Because not only is that a better indicator of whether somebody just by inertia stayed around school and for 6 months until they found a job, whether in Philadelphia or outside, but we know something about young professionals is that they are cycling through a series of jobs and geographic locations in their 20s like they never have before. So the question is, when the music stops in this game of musical chairs, are these folks ending up in Philadelphia? And I think this is particularly important for Philadelphia because this is where our competitive advantage is. It can be a hard sell if somebody is dead set on being 21 years old and staying up until 4 o'clock to experience the city that never sleeps in New York. You know, that student is – that's where they're going to go. But several years down the line when you can't afford that mortgage in New York unless you are extraordinarily wealthy and maybe you're looking to settle down in more of a neighborhood, It's those folks. It's amazing. People in their late 20s, if they don't know Philadelphia, come here and are wowed. So we really want to check. We really want to make sure we're surveying in that mid to late 20s period in order to gauge our overall effectiveness.
And one of the exciting opportunities that we've discovered in our surveys of the college graduates 6 months out is that of the people that left, half of them said that they seriously thought about staying in Philadelphia. And when we've also surveyed current college students and asked them about whether they think they're going to stay in Philadelphia, a number that's about comparable, roughly 20% of the overall population, were undecided. So we think there's a real opportunity to influence anywhere up to 20% of all college students who go through the system. And whether they – even if they leave, we've been talking about ways to keep in touch with alumni because they may, as Josh had mentioned, come back after they've done the New York thing and realize that they can't afford it anymore. They may come back to Philadelphia and set up their family here.
If the two of you could change one thing about Philadelphia that you think would make a difference to attracting and retaining talented 25 to 34-year-olds, what would it be?
I think given where we are right now, it would be telling the new Philadelphia story in a really comprehensive way in terms of economic opportunity. I think there's an outdated picture out there about what the job landscape is here. We certainly, economic development organizations here across the board are focused in a variety of ways on job growth. But in terms of taking that person who thinks, well, pharmaceuticals, that's not my thing. I'm not a white lab coat person. I'm a liberal arts major, and so I'm not going to fit into this economy. To get them to understand that, yes, they can fit into our burgeoning life sciences industry and a variety of other industries. So when I look at where we are overall, through the efforts of Campus Philly, Mayor Street's various initiatives, there's been a lot of good work done on kind of marketing quality of life, and we need to keep on that.
And if I could do one thing, I would say to create a more regional approach. I think that the business community and the mayor have been champions of talking about this as a regional issue because it's not the city versus the suburbs. It's Philadelphia versus Boston or San Francisco or New York. And you know, the mayor's been a leader in funding this initiative and other initiatives, and the higher education community has been part of this. We're focusing on reaching out to engage business leaders in the Philadelphia region on a much more active level with our work than they've been. But the business community has been one of the first set of leaders to really come together regionally. And I think that we have a real challenge here that there's three states in our region, and that makes it much more difficult to operate, you know, when looking at the whole economy because there's so many different players and participants and nonprofits and government entities to work with. So if I could change one thing, I would personally say more regional collaboration. But I do think it's happening.
Well, John and Josh, I want to thank you both for being our guests on Smart City.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks
so much.
John Herman heads Campus Philly. Josh Seven is Manager of Knowledge Industry Initiatives for Philadelphia's Department of Commerce. Do you find yourself checking your moral compass during the day? City View's commentator Walker Smith says context plays as much a part as character.
Every year when I went to Boy Scout camp, there was a special ceremony at the end of the week to induct certain boys into a scout group called the Order of the Arrow. You had to be an overachiever to be considered, and you had to pass certain tests during the week that you wouldn't know about beforehand. For ordinary scouts like me who just wanted to swim and canoe for a week without parental supervision, the Order of the Arrow intrigue was entertainment. We could trade gossip about it as we whiled away the hours whittling on our Indian head neckerchief slides. But one year I saw that it wasn't all fun and games. There was a boy, I learned, who was being considered for the Order of the Arrow. His family was poor and he had no money at camp for any extras. But he was industrious and smart and had a sash full of merit badges. One afternoon, there was talk of another scout who had lost his wallet. Soon after, this boy was asked by an adult scoutmaster to retrieve something from another cabin. As it turned out, that other scout hadn't really lost his wallet. It had been planted in the path that this boy would have to take to complete his errand for the scoutmaster. It was a test to see what he would do with the wallet. I never knew exactly what happened, but this boy was not inducted into the Order of the Arrow. I've always wondered if the temptation of $20 in the lost wallet was just too much for him to resist, and if so, I've always wondered if that was a fair test of his character. If we know someone's weakness and exploit it, have we uncovered something about that person, or have we just proven that anybody can be undone under the right circumstances? This is not to excuse people for not being responsible for their own actions, but it is to recognize that there is more to moral integrity than just the conscience and willpower of the individual. The context within which we find ourselves can sometimes overwhelm even the best of us. This is part of the explanation for what happens in wartime. Morally upstanding people can knowingly and willingly participate in horrific activities, things well beyond the necessity of war, because they become overwhelmed by the context and situation in which they find themselves. The prisoner abuses in Iraq, for example, have been partially accounted for in this way. Now, this is not to let anybody off the hook. It is only to remind us that it is context that enables people to stay true to the best in themselves. We have to build situations that facilitate moral behavior and not depend solely on the moral strength of individuals. In America, we do this through our constitutional rule of law. If we sacrifice it or do end runs around it for temporary crises, even for something as terrible as the threat of global terrorism, we lose our moral context, and thus the framework that has made our country so outstanding in the moral history of the world. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders who just released the new report, Kids in Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.